we don't just dichotomize, but we tend to put things at opposite ends of these continuums and kind of put them against each other. We think that happiness and sadness are opposites. A lot of people would internalize that and would never question that their entire life. But we have experiences, and we even have words and language to describe what it means to be really happy and really sad at the same time. We call it melancholy. In that same way, what it means to be a man or what it means to be a woman aren't opposites, they're different. And a lot of people embody traits or aspects of both of those ideas.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this episode, penises and vaginas, feminism and humanism, faith and prejudice. All coming up in this episode of the Humanist Hour. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Humanist Hour. My name is Beau Bennett, and I'm damn glad to be here. All right, I want you to picture a square. The square is divided into four quadrants. In the upper left quadrant, we have fun and educational. In the upper right, we have not fun, but educational. In the lower left, we have fun, but not educational. And in the lower right, we have not fun and not educational. I like to think that you take all the Humanist Hour podcasts and you could probably stick them into one of those categories. Now, of course, I would hope that everything gets stuck into the fun and educational, but that's not always the case. I'll be the first to admit that. There are a lot that are very educational, very interesting, but not very fun, especially when we talk about some really heavy issues. And there are some podcasts that are a lot of fun, but let's face it, the information we're covering is not very educational. There's not a lot of educational value to it. Well, I'm giving you a Beau Bennett guarantee here that this podcast is both fun and educational. Why? Because today we're speaking with a stage performer, and not just any stage performer who juggles or does mime acts, but a stage performer who talks about gender issues. His name is Sam Killerman, and he's got a couple one-man shows in the Chicago area. So anybody from the Windy City, check him out. All right, let's get to the interview. And I'm speaking with Sam Killerman. How are you, Sam?
I'm well, Beau. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for joining us on the Humanist Hour. It's wonderful to have you.
It's an honor to be here.
All right. Well, there are so many things I want to talk to you about. You're doing some amazing work in, I guess, would the main category be gender issue? If you had to sum up everything you're doing into one word, would that word be gender? If not, what would it be?
I would say justice would be the word, or equity would be the word that I'm, the overall goal of everything that I do is striving towards equity or an equitable society.
Okay. Equity/justice and gender might be a subcategory of what you're doing. All right.
Absolutely.
All right. So I take it that you get the sense in your worldview, there is some injustice going on in this area, and things aren't very equitable at the moment. Let's first start with gender. You have a book out called Guide to Gender, and I believe you're coming out with a second edition very soon.
Yeah, it should be out within the next month or two.
All right, give us the summary description that you would see on Amazon, but in your own words, what that book is about.
It's a book about gender from a social justice perspective that is very much a how-to understanding of gender with the goal of helping people understand gender in a way that will enable them to use that understanding to work towards gender justice or social justice or just equity in their own lives.
Okay. So you consider yourself an advocate, correct?
I do. Yes.
Okay. What exactly are you advocating?
I'm advocating for a world where people of all identities have an equitable access or have equitable access to resources, to happiness, to success, to the ability to be themselves safely and comfortably and happily.
Okay. That makes perfect sense, because obviously if we look at the world today, we see that not everybody with different gender identities have access to those same things. There's not that kind of equality. If you are, and tell me if you agree with me here, if you are strictly male, have a male identity, and you have a penis, then you're good to go. If you're strictly female and you have a vagina, then you're good to go. But if you're somewhere in that other zone, which there are many more people than many people believe, then you've got some issues. Is that correct?
Well, I would say your last that last bit is absolutely correct. But I would also say that folks who are women and have vaginas don't really have the same access to the folks who are men and have penises.
Oh, that's a good point.
But I do want to say I love that you made that clarification, and it sounded like a nod to the TEDx talk I did about gender, where I yelled repeatedly penises and vaginas on stage, and that's my job, and that was like the coolest thing I've ever done, even though my dad was in the front row of that, and I may have been a little bit nervous about that.
Well, I got to say, Sam, I think you get the award for using penis and vagina the most times in a TED talk. So congratulations.
I gotta win something.
That's awesome. I did love your talk. It was a very interesting talk. And to me, the point of the talk was this whole idea that we like to dichotomize this gender issue. And I mean, that's our nature. That's what people do. We like to put things in categories. And some of us, more than others that have this type of personality, like to put things in two categories. If you add a third category, forget it. It's way too confusing. let's just make two categories. And that's what we do with gender. And you go into some very clear detail. I call it clear detail because it's detailed, but it's very clear the way you explain it, how this whole idea of two genders is just fallacious. So can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, on the most like simple factual level, there are many folks who identify outside of those two options. So you either refute those people's existence or the way that they're understanding themselves, or you accept that and you accept that there are more than two genders. On the more complicated or social construction level, we don't just dichotomize, but we tend to put things at opposite ends of these continuums and kind of put them against each other. We have a good knack for that. We think that happiness and sadness are opposites. A lot of people would internalize that and would never question that their entire life. But we have experiences, and we even have words and language to describe what it means to be really happy and really sad at the same time. We call it melancholy, right?
Right.
And in that same way, what it means to be a man or what it means to be a woman aren't opposites, they're different. And a lot of people, and I would argue most people, embody traits or aspects of both of those ideas. They embody traits of manness as well as womanness, or of femininity as well as masculinity. And it's just that our culture and our society has created these two big categories, and we push people to identify within one of the two, but that's limiting and harmful and has some really tragic outcomes.
Right. And I liked how you start off by talking about the difference between a biological sex and gender. And you specifically say that when we're talking about biological sex, well, that's biology. And then that's when you get to use your famous line. Go ahead and use it. I know you want to.
Penises and vagina.
There you go. And then you talk about gender and how gender is basically in the mind. And when we look at that, you said this key word before, which is important, social construction. I think that's wonderful to say when we're talking about gender, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about a social construction. When we're talking about biology, yeah, I guess at some level we're socially constructing. We're saying that this is called a male and this is called female. But generally, biology guides that construction. But when we're talking about gender, we're talking about what goes on in the mind, which is a social construction, and it's all along the spectrum.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and like I said, we think of these, it's easy to think of this as a spectrum with manness on one side and womanness on another side. But what I encourage people to think about, and the thing that I've really brought to this whole conversation, a conversation that's been going on since the 60s, right, is this idea that it's not one spectrum, but it's two or three or four. And we have these different elements of gender. And if you consider the roles and the norms and the expectations, I describe that as manness or womanness, and you can align on the spectrum of manness at one point and identify yourself and plot yourself there. And then on a separate spectrum, your measure or your amount of womanness and how much of those characteristics and traits and expectations you fulfill or live up to. And yeah, it's, you know, I've got this thing that I say that is like a sentence that can be expanded into a book. And I mean, honestly, that's what my book is. But it's that gender is a social construction that's masquerading as a biological imperative.
Very nice. I love how you started the your TED Talk. The first thing you said was, "I'm not gay."
Yep.
Okay. Because yeah. You came out there and there was some laughter there.
There always is.
Why do you think that is?
Because I'm a feminine guy. And that's something that people tend to take gender expression, the way that you display or act out or dress as it pertains to gender. People tend to make assumptions based on gender expression. And I, for my entire adult life, have been explaining to people that I'm not gay. And it wasn't until about 8 or 9 years ago that I understood what was happening. And I realized that it really had nothing to do with my sexuality, but everything to do with the way that I am as a gendered person and the way that people are perceiving that and drawing the connection to my sexuality in a way that for some people, that connection is absolutely there. They express gender in a way to cue their sexuality. Whereas for me, I'm just a very feminine man. And I find that if I don't start out a talk by explaining that I'm not gay, I get some really scared looks when I explain it or when it comes out later. People, it's like I'm shocking their worldview when they find out that I'm attracted to women.
Well, I think that's important, especially when you're out there talking about LGBT issues. Do you think that this is what actually motivated you to get out and do this, the fact that you tend to possess these feminine characteristics?
You know, I find myself answering this question a lot because it is something that raises a lot of eyebrows, and it's difficult for a lot of reasons because there's not one reason, right? Mm-hmm. And the reason that's most salient changes on a day-to-day level, right? Depending on what I'm doing or how I'm feeling or what's in my email inbox, why do I keep doing what I do is different. But I am very committed to this idea that we can live in this just society or in a just globe where people in all societies and all people in all societies have the ability to be who they are and be supported in that. And I have not felt that way with the way that I am as a gendered person specifically. It's not my sexuality that has gotten me to where I am. It's the way that I am as it pertains to gender that first started triggering all these reactions and all these like internal dialogues that got me fascinated in these concepts. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I was fascinated, as soon as I started reading about them, I just got absolutely hooked. And I think that as anybody knows, it's kind of like a rabbit hole when you start looking into identity and big constructs like social psychology and what does it actually mean to be the type of person that you are and what's affecting you on the conscious and subconscious levels. Like, are we rational? Are we not? Like all these great big questions. And the more you ask them and try to answer them, the more you want to ask and answer them more.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a selfless or a trying to help the other, or at least not solely. And I think that if it were, it wouldn't be sustainable and it also wouldn't be true.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and we're speaking with Sam Killerman, author of Guide to Gender.
But for me, it's a recognition that justice is good for everybody, and that kind of like the inverse of a very famous Martin Luther King Jr. quote, that an injustice anywhere is an injustice everywhere. I think that justice served for any group is justice served for every group. And we all benefit mutually and interdependently from these movements and from this education and this knowledge. So yeah, I don't know. I you can tell it's a hard one for me to answer, and I should know how to answer it.
No, that's okay. You know, sometimes, and you made the point there that the answer may change depending on what's most salient, and rather than you just making something up, I'm glad I like that answer. It's honest, and it just goes to show sometimes we just don't exactly know exactly what motivates us. And I think that's very fair. And I do want to point out that a lot of the work that I do, the charitable work that I do, is with the Humanist Association, and I'm a humanist. So obviously there's the direct connection there. I also do work with Toastmasters International, but I'm a public speaker. You know, so there are these connections, and that's what motivates us. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just kind of surprising at times when people focus on an issue. It's surprising to me when people focus on an issue when they don't appear to have like a direct connection to it.
Yeah.
But it's just we're all motivated by something, and I'm of the idea that pretty much everything we do somehow benefits us personally.
We all do stuff
to self-interest. I mean, there is some self-interest, even if it's just it makes us feel good inside.
Yeah,
if that's
for sure.
If that's it, then that's good enough. It's good, yep. And there's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. All right, you said something else that I do think is worthy of repeating because it's kind of an important issue. One of the questions I had here on my list is something you've already answered, and that question was, how much of gender behavior do you think is a result of somebody attempting to communicate their sexual orientation?
That's a really hard question to answer. But what I will say is that there is a distinct difference between expressing or behaving in a gendered way and cueing your gender or your sexuality. And from the outside, looking in or looking at a person, you might not be able to guess what's happening, but on the inside looking out, you can intentionally do one of the two of those things. You can just express gender in a way because that's who you are, and it might be saying something else about you altogether, or you can express gender in a particular way to try to cue something else about your identity, that you're gay or you're lesbian or you're queer or you're bisexual or any other sexual identity, you're straight, you're very, very straight. I'm not sure what that one would be.
Let me ask you this from personal experience. You're a good looking guy. Are you married?
No, I'm in a committed relationship.
Maybe if you could take me back before you got into this relationship. I would guess that if you had the same outward expression of your gender, you would be hit on a lot more guys than women, than girls.
That was an issue, yes. It still is. And you know what's funny is I'm one of my only friends who isn't gay, who gets set up on a lot of gay blind dates. And I don't mind because I make friends, but I find that the other guy's usually disappointed.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, it definitely happens. And the other side too, I tell this story, one of the first experiences I had where I realized that people were misperceiving me as gay was one of my first, like, who I thought was my girlfriend in college, and she thought I was her gay best friend.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
How disappointing is that?
Yeah, it was a little bit of a letdown.
Oh, geez.
And I was pretty thrown off and kind of terrified. But you know what I found is that if I were to present my gender in a way that would be more heteronormative and wouldn't lead to those expectations, what I would end up doing is presenting an insincere version of myself. And I did that in college and in grad school because I wasn't as comfortable with myself as I am now. Mm-hmm. And what happened was when I would end up dating somebody, if I were presenting in that very heteronormative, masculine, dude kind of way, they would then get to know me and there would just be this incongruence between the type of man, if we want to go with that, that I was advertising and the type of person that I actually am. And I would much rather have all these other, like, kind of, I think of them as funny mix-ups, and at least be presenting how I feel on the inside than present myself in an insincere way and end up in insincere relationships.
Here's an idea that I had, Sam. Tell me what you think of it.
Bring it.
It was way back. What about like some kind of cool iPhone app or mobile device app that when you're in a bar or in a place where there's a bunch of people, kind of single people, it kind of signals as to who's interested, who's single, who's looking for somebody, and if they're looking for a male or female. So it could be little colors. So you don't even have to worry about all these social cues and trying to figure things out and play detective. You just pick up your iPhone and you look at some guy or some girl and say, okay, that person is single and they're interested in finding a male. And you could even go further than that. You could say they like long walks on the beach and they like, you know, you could see all that. Yeah. And then you could go up to the person. How cool would that be?
I think what you're describing is, I've never actually used this, but isn't that what Tinder is?
Is that what it is?
I'm not sure.
I've been married for 20 years, so I don't know.
I think it might already exist. I'm not sure. But if it doesn't, I would love to make it with you.
All right. I'm going to write that down for ideas to pursue. Tinder. Okay. Yeah. All right. Back to the interview. So how do you think what we think about, the cognitive aspects, what we feel, the affective aspects, and how we behave, the behavioral aspects, all play a role in gender.
Well, you know, it's funny because I think that all three of those also play into the sex as well. So into the biological aspect, because as much as we on the fundamental level can separate biology or sex and gender as the, you know, the identity in the social and in the mind, in a lot of ways, it's not that simple and they're not that discrete. Like sex is more than just penises and vaginas. You know, I joke about that in the TED talk because that's what people think of when they think of sex and they think of the sex as it relates to gender, but it's much more than that. It's about our chromosomes, which we can't see, and our body hair, which we can. It's about the width of our hips. It's about the width of our shoulders, how pronounced our jawline is, how low our voice is. And some of those things we can actually affect through our ways of performing gender. You can speak in a higher voice, which is a way of performing femaleness, or you can speak in a lower voice, which is a way of performing maleness. And that may or may not relate to how you hear your inner monologue, which gets into that effective that you were talking about with the cognitive or the more psychological aspect of gender. Is do you hear yourself in a high pitch in your head and that's why you speak in a high pitched voice, or do you not? Is there a conflict there or is there congruence? And, you know, I think that this is why I love this topic and this is why I find it so fascinating. But what I will say is that when I talk about these things, one of the things that I've always tried to do is to not make them overtly complicated and to not make them hard or inaccessible, because there is a lot of that and that's fun and I love doing that right now. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's so much value in trying to present the most inclusive but also the most accessible version of any form of knowledge to try to interest people so that they can start having these conversations themselves.
Okay. All right, Sam. So I take it you've heard of the Kinsey scale before, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. And for our listeners, that's the idea. Alfred Kinsey, I believe his name was, back in the 50s. He had 50s or 60s, 40s, somewhere around there. He had a scale that he did. He was a psychologist. He tested sexuality, and it was from 0 to 6. 0 meaning you're completely heterosexual, and 6 meaning you're completely homosexual, and then all the numbers in between. So as somebody who you're self-described as having some feminine traits as well, do you still see yourself as 0 on that scale, or a 1, a 2, or is that, in your mind, is that, that's sexuality, sexual attraction, and I'm definitely, that's not what we're talking about when we're talking about gender. So how do you see that? How do you mix those?
I see them as very separate things.
Okay.
And while some people see gender as a manifestation of sexuality, there are some good arguments that I've seen there, and I think that's an interesting conversation to have. I think that the way that we think about gender and the way that I think about sexuality, I think about them as discrete things that are often interrelated and have strong relationships to one another, but we embody in unique ways. And so, that scale wouldn't be, my femininity wouldn't really register on the Kinsey scale.
Okay.
There's this other test called the BEM Sex Role Inventory.
Right.
Are you familiar with it?
I am, yes.
Okay, then, and that would be the closest thing that I know of that's in the literature that's pretty well established, that's like a good form of measuring gender.
Yeah.
Okay. And yeah, so, but the interesting thing about all of this is that for some people, their gender does determine their sexuality, or at least their sexuality determines their gender. And for other people, they're very separate. And I would be one of those people that I would describe as being in the second camp, where I see my gender as this one aspect of myself, and I see my sexuality as this other aspect of myself.
So a good summary, I think, would be to say that that gender and sexuality are correlated, but they don't necessarily have to be.
Yeah, I would say they are often correlated, but there's no causality there. One doesn't necessarily cause the other.
Right. That's a good summary. Okay. Well, let's move on to another issue that you have some experience with, and that's feminism. Feminism versus humanism.
Yeah.
Now, I mentioned to you earlier before we started recording that I don't have a lot of experience with feminism. So I need you to treat me like I'm very uneducated in this area and walk me through slowly.
Okay.
One of the contentions with feminism that I hear often is that it doesn't seem to be compatible with humanism. And so maybe if you could kind of give us an introduction to feminism and then perhaps tell us if you think it's compatible with humanism, and if so, how?
Yeah, that's so I don't, I just want to start by saying I don't see feminism and humanism as mutually exclusive in any way. And I see feminism as one of the goals of humanism, where I see them as having very similar goals that align in a very compatible way. And that if feminism were to succeed, that's a very absolutist term to use, but if the goals of the brand of feminism that I ascribe to were accomplished, they would fulfill a lot of the goals of humanism as well. So the way I see feminism is a movement for equity or justice or equality. People use these words interchangeably. I see them as very different, but pick one for folks of all genders. And what that means is remedying what exists in our society right now as a subjugation of femininity, womanness, or femaleness. And in many ways, all three of those independently and together.
Okay. All right. So from what I understand, some of the objections to feminism have to do with, I guess, the kind of the equivalent of affirmative action in a way. With feminism, that we need to overcompensate in order to make up for. I don't know if that's the right term, but is there any truth to that? Do you see that a lot?
You know, I think there's definitely some truth to it in the sense that there are some people who identify with feminism or identify as feminists who see that as a goal of feminism. They see kind of like a reparations style movement, or that it needs to be. We need to push past equality towards reparations for women, and I, you know, ultimately when we start talking about these things, I can't help but think of the no true Scotsman logical fallacy. It always pops into my mind because anytime you're talking about this entire group of anybody, you can pick a representative as a spokesperson, or someone can appoint themselves.
Right.
Or if you're someone who supports the goals, you can pick someone else. If you're someone who refutes the goals, you can pick someone else, whatever, to reconcile your idea of what that group is. And you can find somebody in any group who will say something that will support your feelings about that group. It's very possible.
So essentially, we could see somebody who calls themselves a feminist, and they could be saying some ridiculous crap, and we could say, no, she's not a true feminist, or he's not a true feminist.
Yeah.
And then we could just redefine feminism to match our idea of what feminism is and say that's what feminism is.
Absolutely. And I think that happens on both sides of every issue. You know, it happens as I identify as a feminist, I identify as a humanist as well. But it definitely happens with me. I wrote this article that got, that's probably, I think it's the most popular article I've ever written, that was 5 reasons why people think feminism hates men and why they're not true. And it's kind of like a historical review. It talks about the social psychology of where this idea that feminism equals man-hating comes from. Mm. And the reason why I wrote that was because I got kind of sick of having that conversation. I just wanted something to link to. And in writing that, it was odd because it evoked that response from so many people. The response of there were many feminists, self-identified feminists, who said, this article is perfect. This is exactly how I feel. And then there were some as well who said, nope, I actually hate men. This article is wrong. And I thought it was really like an odd little like micro study of the thing that I was writing about.
Oh, that's interesting. I do see a lot of similarities with feminism and atheism in a way, because we're both like atheists. Many atheists come from some kind of religion in Christianity, and maybe there is some bitterness towards that group.
Yeah.
And that bitterness does show in our behaviors, in the way that we talk about the other group, the out group now, the way that we respond to posts on the internet, the articles that we write. And that may give some people the wrong impression. And I wonder, what I've seen so far in the atheist community is that when somebody first becomes an atheist after leaving religion, they tend to be bitter. They tend to have an increasing bitterness. And at some point that subsides. Like maybe it might take a year, a couple of years, and then they're kind of like a relaxed atheist, if you want to call them that. And I wonder if the same thing kind of happens with feminism and feminists. So maybe somebody new to the movement might get all riled up, and maybe there's some of those feelings, that negativity that shows, and then after a while, they start to mellow out a little bit. And maybe what some people are doing is they're looking at some of those who might be bitter, and they're thinking that they're representative of the whole movement, which is not true in atheism. So I would say that that is probably not true in feminism.
Yeah, you know, I've never actually seen any good data on this, right? So a lot of this comes from anecdote, and a lot of it just comes from hunch. Yes. But I will say that in my master's, what I studied was learning, development, and growth. Basically, but we focus on college students. What does it take for a person to get from this high school mindset of dependency on their parents towards through this like independent mindset of college where they're just, you know, they're on their own and they don't need anybody's help, into this idea of interdependence as a contributing member of society? And there is this idea of duality or dualism that, you know, there's an absolute right and wrong, and this other idea of cognitive complexity that there really isn't a right or wrong. And I think that in a lot of ways, moving from dualism toward cognitive complexity or moving from dependence towards interdependence, mm-hmm. there's this kind of rough middle step where you just completely reject the thing that pushed you away. And I identify as an atheist, and I definitely went through the phase that you just described in atheism. And for some folks, if they're challenged and supported in a sufficient way, they'll make it through that stage and into a stage where they recognize that that aspect of their identity is just one part of their identity. I'm an atheist, but I'm also a full person. And my atheism stands separate from religion. My atheism is a part of me, but it's not that I'm anti-religious. It's that I'm atheist.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and we're speaking with Sam Killerman, author of Guide to Gender.
I think that's a wonderful goal. I don't think everybody makes it. I don't think it's just a matter of time. I think it's a matter of the support systems you have and the opportunities you have for growth. But I do think that all too often people are whether intentionally or not, cherry picking those people who are in that resentment, bitterness stage and using them to discredit the entire group. And yeah, you see it in atheism, you see it in feminism, you see it in any movement for equity or equality.
Yeah. Let's look at those two words that you just used, equity and equality. And maybe I'm off on this, or I have one of the words wrong, but I've heard somebody explain the difference between the two before, because if we look from a purely scientific biological perspective, obviously men and women are not the same. And this is something that that earlier science has been, I guess there's a black mark on it, because science at times in liberal institutions tends to be politicized, and some of the findings may be interpreted in such a way to try to be politically correct, when at times it's actually screwing up the science itself and the findings. And recently there have probably, like in the last 5 or 10 years, a lot of these biological and sex differences have been coming out to the forefront and saying, well, look, this is the way it is. Like there's no discussion here. There's no doubt. I mean, this is the way things are. But now the question is, what do we do about them? Do you think there's a difference between when we're talking about equality, that we could say men and women are not equal in many ways, but there should be equity among men and women? Is that the way that that some people put it?
I describe the difference between equity and equality quite simply as equity being a society where people have a just or fair access to whatever it is we describe as good, whatever resource we want to talk about. Whereas equality would describe a society or a world in which everybody has the same of everything. So an equal society would mean everyone makes the same wage, everyone has the same amount of smiles, everyone has the same amount of hugs and dollars in the bank and job or whatever. And that's why a lot of people debunk any social justice movement, because they say equality, like, that's just, you know, that's not fair because some people work more, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas equity means removing barriers that unrealistically or unfairly or unjustly prevent people from access to those things. So I guess when it comes to, like, are men and women equal, I don't think men and women are equal or equitable. And I don't think any two people are equal, really. And I don't think that the groups of men and women are as helpful, or I don't think they would be as helpful as they are now in the society that I idealize or that I strive towards.
Okay. So I'm just thinking of playing devil's advocate here and thinking of some issues I've heard before, especially from the conservative side, talking about, well, as a woman, you are better suited biologically to care for a child. That's one argument that's been made. As a man, you're better suited for heavy labor, for physical labor. So there are some things that it's kind of difficult to argue with based on biology, but then there's that social issue. Okay, well, now that we know that you may be better off statistically to do this, but now what should we do about it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that there's, I don't like the other, I don't like the gender blind idea or the sex blind idea that we're all the same and that we're all, that these aren't differences. There are differences, right? There are definitely physical differences between people of different sexes. There are physical differences between people of different races. And to say that those don't exist, I think is silly. But the conclusions that we draw from them are often misinformed. We're drawing conclusions based on it's science done in reverse. We want these conclusions to be true. We want these we want to explain how society is. So we're looking for evidence that supports that hypothesis instead of just looking at the evidence objectively and allowing the conclusions to be supported by that evidence. And you find that when you look at a lot of things like the theories that have been presented over the last forever about mating and why are men this way and why are women this way? Men have to spread their seed. Women want to settle down. That's what explains why men cheat more and why women, et cetera. And most of those, I mean, like that theory specifically, have been debunked over and over and over again by sociologists, psychologists, anthropologists, but they're perfect explanations to when you want to find evidence to support the conclusion that you already want to make, you can totally find the evidence, right?
Right. Okay. Well, let's move on. Let's move on to the show that you do, the one-man show called In-Tolerance. Faith,
yeah.
Prejudice, and what else?
An identity.
Faith, Prejudice, and Identity. So that's a one-man show that you're doing in the Chicago area. So tell us all about that one.
Yep. Stand-up style comedic talk, I guess, is how I would describe it.
All right. So what's the main point of that performance?
The big idea that I was trying to get at was I find myself in this odd space. I'm often misperceived as a lot of different things. So we talked earlier about how people tend to assume I'm gay. I'm not gay. People tend to assume that I'm a Christian and I'm not a Christian. People, when they find out that I'm straight, are often like surprised to a point of discomfort. And similarly, when they find out that I don't have a faith, that I am atheist, they are similarly surprised to a level of discomfort. But the odd thing is that I get this hate mail from people of all four of those groups. I get hate mail from straight and cisgender people. I get hate mail from Christian and religious people. I get hate mail from atheists or non-religious people. And I get hate mail from queer or LGBTQ people. And a lot of that hate mail is based on the idea of my identity, whether they accurately pinpoint it or not. And it's odd because that's been happening for years now. And it wasn't until recently that I wanted to start talking about it. And the show is basically about the people who we allow to speak on behalf of our groups, who often tend to be the most extreme, far end of each of these polar opposites, as we perceive them, identities, who don't really represent many of us in the middle. And why we allow that to happen, why we allow those spokespeople to cloud our understanding of what those groups mean or who those people are, and basically what we can do about it.
And that's very interesting. I'm thinking of the media effect as you're telling me this. If you are, if you're involved in media, who do you want to get more clicks? Who do you want to write an article to get more clicks to your website, yep, or more views to your page? You want somebody with these crazy ass extreme views.
Yep.
Who just spews out this crazy stuff, and that's what does it. I mean, how many? First of all, I don't watch Fox News, but I can't tell you how many clips of Fox News that I actually watched due to people posting things where people say some crazy things, and they get hits.
They do.
It gets traffic. It gets attention.
I watch them too.
Yeah,
I've been on the receiving end of the Fox News hate target, or whatever you'd want to call it. And what's amazing is that when you're in their crosshairs and the folks who follow them, the amount of like just sheer rage that I've received in my inbox as a result of being a talking point on Fox News is part of what drove me to write this show.
Wow. So people are just upset with your expression of gender? I mean, is that what it comes down to, or is it something that you're actually saying in your writing or your shows?
I think ultimately it's odd because we could simplify this as like a left versus right issue, like a liberal versus conservative issue.
Okay.
And the radical left and the radical right, folks who identify in the radical left and folks who identify in the radical right, what's odd is that the emails that I get from them are so similar that I often have these like mental jokes about how much fun they'd have at a cocktail party, despite like if they didn't know going in that they were supposed to hate each other,
right,
how similar they are and how fascinating I find that. I mean, their issues couldn't be more different, right? Like the way they stand on these different issues, but the way that they're trying to accomplish them is so similar. It's almost unsettling. And I identify and I try as hard as I can in all of my work to aim for the middle. Like the 90% in the middle, not the 5% on any extreme of any issue, because one, those folks are interested in learning. Two, I don't. Not only do I think that the folks on the extremes aren't interested, I don't like the idea of arguing for the sake of arguing. If I want to argue, it's because I want to achieve something, and those arguments aren't going to achieve anything. And three, those people just scare me. I get a lot of death threats. I get a lot of really horrifying emails from people, and I would just rather not engage.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So this show, it was just like, I wanted to try to tackle this. And how do you write a comedy show about hate mail? It's basically what it all came down to. And part of it was me acknowledging my own prejudice. As you mentioned, as an atheist, you know, having some bitterness towards religion, I definitely had that. I had some bad experiences with Christianity and with religion growing up. And I part of me acknowledging my own prejudice and my own discomfort was I did the show in a church, and it was the first time I'd been in a church in a long time. I'm physically uncomfortable in churches for a lot of reasons. And that was like my trying to like find the middle ground. It's like, I'm coming to your safe place to have this conversation. And that by itself was like a learning experience for me.
Do you know why you're uncomfortable in church?
Yeah, you know, a lot of the...
No, I was gonna tell you why.
Oh, go. Yeah, please tell me why.
It's because of the demons trying to get out.
That's honestly why.
That's why, and that's the only reason why.
It's because of people saying that to me that I'm uncomfortable in church.
Yeah, that's probably more accurate.
Yeah, I mean, it's seriously. What's funny is like when I tell people, when I try to talk with religious folks or Christian folks about how I'm uncomfortable in churches, they say things that make like their explanations for why, like not as extreme as that one, most of them. But I'm like, oh my gosh, now like you're trying to help, but you're making it worse. They're like, do you think it's because you're suffering or like addressing the sin that you haven't addressed. Right. Like, no, but now I will. Like, now that's going to be going through my head.
Yeah. Don't worry. You're not a sinner. Sin doesn't exist. You're okay.
Yeah.
You're doing all right.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of relativism.
Nice. So the show is called Intolerance. Is there a dash there, or are they two words?
It's like a camel case, capital I, capital T. Is how I did it to try to hit at the crossroads of the word intolerance and acting in tolerance.
Okay. And tell us about this book that's coming out, the second edition, Guide to Gender. Where can people get it? Where can they find out more information about it?
Guide2gender.com is the website for the book. You can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all that kind of stuff. If you go to Guide to Gender, you can sign up for emails or get a copy of the first edition. The second edition is, like most second editions, just going to be a lot of the same from the first, with some expansions, some reflections, and honestly, just a few of the typos from the first one cleaned up.
Yeah. Got a lot of those in my first editions.
I bet. It's kind of, if you didn't, it would almost be unnerving.
Right. Well, Sam, this has been really fun. I really appreciate the conversation. As I mentioned to you before we started recording, it's something different that I don't usually talk about on the show, but I love to talk about these issues. It's really fun, really enlightening. So thank you for the education. I appreciate it.
Hey, like I said, it's an honor to be here. I love talking about these things, and thanks for the time.
Yeah, you bet. All right, you take care.
You too. Bye, Bob.
Well, that was Mr. Sam Killerman, author of the book Guide to Gender, available at the website. It's pronounced metrosexual.com. I love this conversation. I really like Sam. The reason probably this resonated with me so much is because I had a sort of similar issue growing up. First of all, I don't like sports at all. I can't stand watching sports. I have no interest in team sports. All the sports that I've always done were independent sports, like weightlifting and martial arts and skiing and tennis. And when I say tennis, I mean usually just hitting the tennis ball against the wall. I don't know, maybe it's a competition aspect of it. I don't know, but I do not like sports one bit. I love musicals, and that's fairly recent. I don't think that happened until after I was married, when I heard my first musical. I just kind of fell in love with it, and I really like musicals. And generally, I'm much better friends with women than I am men. So all three of these factors, one could look at this and start to question their own sexuality. But I assure you, listeners, I am very much hetero. I would be a zero on the Kinsey scale. Not that it matters, but just if anyone's curious. However, the whole separation of the sexuality and gender does make a lot of sense. And why don't I like team sports? Why do I love musicals? I don't know. It could be a cultural thing. It could be partly biological. There could be many reasons for it. But the fact is, it just is. And that doesn't make me any less of a man. And I like that message. I like the message because it allows people to be themselves without having to fake it, without having to put on this facade and pretend they're someone they're not, and try to act macho or try to act feminine if you are a woman trying to fit into that role. So I really like this idea. And it's funny, too, because Sam and I were talking about this before we started recording. This happens to both of us, and I'm sure it happens to a lot of you out there who don't like sports. But that seems to be the one key issue that bonds strange men. So generally, if you run into somebody you've never met before, and let's say you're at a barber shop, the barber will say, "Hey, did you catch that game last night?" And I hear that all the time. And I used to try to just kind of go along with them and say, "Yeah, great game," but I got in trouble. Because then they start talking specifics, and I start talking about basketball when they were obviously talking about football, and it's a very awkward situation. And then I tried a different strategy. When somebody said, "Hey, you catch that game last night?" I said, "No, I'm sorry, I'm just not into sports." And then there's like this dull cricket sound. You can almost hear the crickets in the back. Just a very awkward moment. So I go for a different strategy now. So if I run into you at a conference, well, first of all, you'll know not to ask me about sports and if I catch the game, but just say you did. you'd say, hey, Bo, you catch the game last night? And I'd say, ah, no, I missed it. And then you might proceed to tell me some of the details, but I'd quickly interrupt you with a different subject. So I've gotten quite good at this, without making an awkward situation, and without lying, which is important as well, or without misleading anybody. If you ask me if I've seen the game, I just say, no, I missed it. And if you start talking about sports, I politely change the subject away from sports to something else where we might have some common similarities. So there is your social tip of the day by Bo Bennett. All right, and I just want to remind you why everybody's setting up their plans for the summer, if you're getting a head start, to hold aside May 7th through 10th. And that's, I guess technically that's still the spring. So if you're setting up your vacation for the summer, think spring too, because you can't forget about the spring. May 7th through 10th in Denver, Colorado, is the American Humanist Association Mile High Humanism Conference. So you don't want to miss that. Again, that's in Denver, Colorado, May 7th through 10th. You could check out that at conference.americanhumanist.org, and you will find the schedule with the speakers who are already lined up to be there, along with exhibitors and other information. One more plug, if you haven't checked it out yet, check out the new website, askahumanist.com. If you have questions about humanism, or if you have answers, that's the place to be. So again, that's askahumanist.com. Go check it out. All right, folks, that'll be it for this episode. My name is Bo Bennett. We'll see you next time on The Humanist Hour. Bye-bye, everybody.